I think that's kind of like where solo gaming in the modern incarnation kind of like spreads out from, because like then it started kind of picking up, and with COVID, obviously, like everyone was stuck at home, usually with people who didn't play war games. So you had to, oh, okay, I
What
need
has
to,
he done?
okay, that is a big bug. We're gonna have to have a quick break here.
Oh, snap. Bug break. It's us. We're here.
Yes.
It's your Bad Internet Friends podcast,
Hey.
episode 14. You
Visual
know,
podcast.
unfortunately, we had to postpone it one day due to a soccer game. But if we had done it yesterday, it would have been the 14th episode on the 14th day.
Oh.
Missed opportunity.
Yes.
So I am David of Axe Annex, and this is.
Ivan of not Axe Annex. I am the Nordic Weasel Games guy. That if you're in the chat, you're probably part of the captive audience.
That's right.
Well, if you're in the chat, statistically, you presumably know at least one of us. If you are an absolute stranger, then hi, we hope you have a good time.
Yes,
But
please.
we would be really curious how you stumble into this.
100% curious. Oh yeah, I've renamed the channel from Axe Annex, which was my old project, to the only thing I'm currently doing on the channel, which is Bad Internet Friends Podcast. So that's what we're called now.
That is
Though I may
commitment.
still put up content that is under Axe Annex, I'll just mention
Yeah.
it as such.
It's in
Nice.
what do they call it? Like an affiliate brand.
Yeah, that's right. It's just me.
Yeah. So, but it's all kind of related anyway. Oh, we have a poster.
I am no
Excellent.
strange, but I am strange. Riddles and riddles. Oh, there we go. Stranger. Mystery solved.
Riddles in the deck.
So today we are coming in to talk about the solo wargaming experience and why it's good, so good.
Yes, and I guess a little bit about just different ways people have done solo. We're going to look at a couple of different games from old to new, and then we'll just kind of see where the chat goes. Maybe talk a little bit about game design. If it turns out to be too long, we may split it into two, so you get two episodes for the price of one.
Yeah, game design
And
episodes are always fun.
since you didn't pay anything for it, I guess that's like infinite episodes per dollar.
It's more money for less money.
Let's see. So what you do is you listen to all the episodes, then you sell them on, and now you have an infinite money machine. It's
Yes,
much
yes.
far more efficient than mining bitcoins or whatever the kids are doing these days.
All right, so we said hello to Lon Jennings, and we're going to say hi to Skies.
Who is
He doesn't know.
definitely a random
Yeah,
stranger.
we don't know him whatsoever.
But could be a friend. Sounds a lot like a friend of the show.
Yeah, seems like all right. We'll
So
see.
we'll just. I keep being distracted here because the cat is like attacking the curtain, which probably means there's an insect. Lancelot, what are you
Well,
doing? Get
hopefully
off
it's
of
not a
there.
horrifying bug.
Yeah, well, either it's really big and gross, in that case I'm okay with him eating it, or it's poisonous, and I don't want him to eat it. Or he's just stupid and imagining it. Lancelot, get off of there. Oh my god, cat. But I guess I'll kind of start. This is not going to be like the grand history of solo gaming, because that goes back to like a bunch of like old historical stuff, like Grant, those old Grant books and stuff like that. Rather, it is going to be kind of the start of like modern solo gaming. Because there was a long time where solo gaming was either not really a thing, or it was just a thing you sort of like made up on your own.
Yeah, a
Maybe
lot
you
of people
played.
saw it as like two-fisting, right? Like, why do I want to play a solo game? I'm just playing by myself, against myself.
Or even if you did mostly play solo, that was still how you did it. You just kind of played both sides, right? But there wasn't a lot of games didn't have like mechanics to play solo. Certainly, there were very few games that were specifically intended for it. And there's been a couple of different games people have suggested for like where it really starts. But I think for a lot, it really started with 2 hour war games. Nuts 5150. The original, I think, was Chain Reaction. I'm not sure. He had like a bunch of different little games, and then it kind of like came together with Chain Reaction and Nuts and all that stuff. And I think a lot of people who are solo gamers, especially like solo skirmish gamers, have like encountered their games at some point. There's like 1,000 of them. They're a big influence on like early, mostly like Five Men in Normandy, honestly. And we played conservatively, I would say like 1,000 games of Nuts and the original 5150. So we got pretty into the system and threw it and out on the other side. But it was always, because there's kind of two components to how he did solo. The first was that you had these like reaction rules, so that when you play the game, and sometimes it feels online like nobody understands how they work. But the short version is that when certain things happen, like you see an enemy or you shoot at somebody or they shoot at you or whatever, there's a reaction test you take and you roll, and different things can happen. And some of the games, it depends on like what kind of soldier it is or what kind of alien it is or whatever. So there's like unpredictable things that can happen. And the same system is also used for like, you determine like what the enemy does. If they roll, you roll two dice and compare it to like their stat, which is how good they are. Rep, it's called. And like, if they pass both, they're usually more aggressive. If they pass one of the dice, they might like hang back and shoot, or they might try to flank you. And if they fail them, they might stick around where they are. So it was essentially like a dice-based AI, but it was very kind of like open-ended. There was definitely like a lot of interpretation of like, okay, what does it mean exactly for them to like outflank you, depending on like what your actual table situation is, because it was very subtle. It wasn't tied into like a bunch of conditions. It was meant to be very simple. The other piece of it was that the way the game worked, a lot of times when you played, you would be up against maybe a single enemy squad, or and they would potentially get reinforcements as you were playing. So you might run into a tank, or you might run into, you know, a bunch of infantry, or it might just be like one squad and that's all you're dealing with. And in some missions, you would have essentially blips where there would be, I think they call them possible enemy forces. And they kind of move around randomly. And when you spot one of them, it can turn out that's like an enemy squad or a vehicle or like some dudes in a trench or some, or a space tank or some space infantry or some space dudes in a space trench if you're playing 5150. It all kind of works the same across the different games. So that's the basic idea of it, that there is like some unpredictable elements to how the enemy acts, which is diced for. And as you play, those games usually don't have very many specific scenarios. The idea is that you kind of set up, you know, you have a basic mission you're trying to do, but the enemies you encounter can kind of vary. And sometimes it'll be just like a quick battle that you send in a squad of your guys and there's just one squad of theirs and you kind of drive them off. And sometimes you run into like an entire like tank platoon and you are just kind of fucked. You have to run away or hope you can get some reinforcements. And the games always had this quality where they were kind of written like they could be played player versus player, which we did quite a bit, or you could play them solo against like the system, or you could be, he would always like talk about how you could play together, but it was mostly just like, it's the same as like what I used to do, which is just you split the troops between you. So like we're sitting down to play Nuts together. It just means I have five guys, you have five guys, and then we play together. But it was not like specifically a cooperative game beyond that. Now he's done a ton of other stuff, some stuff which is more RPG oriented, some stuff which is very like military. He adopted the rules to a bunch of stuff. But that was kind of the basics of 2-hour war games. And the chain reaction system. I think that's kind of like where solo gaming in the modern incarnation kind of like spreads out from, because like then it started kind of picking up, and with COVID, obviously, like everyone was stuck at home, usually with people who didn't play war games. So you had to. Oh, okay.
Is he done?
okay, that is a big bug. We're going to have to have a quick break here.
Oh, snap. Bug break. All right. While Ivan is battling the bug, may he be victorious or forever rest in Valhalla, I will talk about, what do we got here? Earth texture. Vejo's earth texture. Terrific stuff. I love it. I like to spread it with a spoon. Spoon like this. Sometimes I'll use like an old like nylon brush to spread it, but I hate it. It's a spoon. The spatula, I love. Oh, there he is. He lived.
Yes, I trapped it in a plastic container.
Yes.
I was just going to let you take over, because I think that was kind of the end of the 2-hour war games.
Oh, okay. Segment. So,
like, it was kind of, like, that's where a lot of, certainly players, but also a lot of people who would then spring off and design, like, the next wave of solo games, that's kind of where they got their start from, because it also started showing up, like people would talk about it on like RPG.net or stuff like that. So it's kind of spread out across different areas and different groups.
Do Canadians have a different idea of what a spoon is? No, sometimes words just escape me. I mean, it's kind of spoon-like, though. I mean, it's not that far off from a spoon, right? It's just kind of spoon. You probably can't eat soup with it, but you could still scoop.
Yeah,
you could have ice cream for sure. You could eat ice cream with this.
You may have to like hustle at it. Like you can't wait too long.
Okay, I got two questions for 2 hours War Games.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is it true that basically you could just roll the dice and it will keep playing itself?
You have to make some decision at some point, but there is kind of an element, which is where the chain reaction name came from, where like you move a guy and he spots some enemies and they shoot at you. And now your dude and some dudes near him are diving for cover, but some of them are shooting back, and those shots may catch some other dudes who are now running away. So you get these like long chains of events that'll link together. And yes, you can get into these kind of grinds where like you're just rolling dice. Like the classic one is you have two guys in cover who are bad at shooting and they can't hit each other very well. So I shoot at you and miss. Then you roll for reactions and shoot back and miss. Then I roll for reaction. That could go on like for a while. But you do have to make some decisions here and there. Like you're still, you know, deciding where you're moving, what you're shooting at.
My other question is, would you say its biggest strength would be its ability to tell a story? Because it's something that's completely out of your control to a large degree.
Yeah, so, I think it's interesting, actually, because the game doesn't really have mechanics to tell a story, but it creates one anyway. Like, if you went out with one squad and you run into, like, a whole bunch of enemies, like a whole enemy platoon with several tanks and stuff, and you barely hold on and you manage to fight some of them off, like, that kind of generates a story automatically, right? Mm-hmm. Just because things happened and we immediately start like envisioning them and trying to put some logic into them, right?
Okay. So you found that like a lot when you were playing it on the table, the mm-hmm. story would just start unfolding before you.
Yeah, I would say it's at the level where it's more that it becomes very vivid. I don't think it generates like a huge long story, like across games necessarily.
Okay.
But it definitely like creates like a very lively experience when you're playing, because you get that element of like things you didn't expect happening. So it feels like the world is alive beyond just like what you like. You know, you brought like 10, you know, Canadian infantry, right?
Mm-hmm.
But anything that happens that you didn't select specifically is, yeah, that kind of generates like some story. But it's definitely more on the end of like being a miniature scene. As opposed to trying to be like a role-playing game or stuff. Like later they would kind of dip into that, but that's not like the classic system, I would say.
Yeah. Would you say that the two biggest strengths for solo wargaming, like a good one, mm-hmm. would be either something happening that you don't expect
mm-hmm.
or something that creates a good story, which doesn't necessarily have to be the same thing?
Yeah, I was going to quibble to say those aren't the same thing. And I think one is probably like a requirement for the game to kind of work. Because if you're playing solo, like the biggest concern is, I'm just making sure the cat doesn't liberate the bug and try to eat him. Well, he looks like, I think he's what one of those like solitary wasps that are like not dangerous.
Oh, okay. A ground bee.
Yeah. Like, but I don't necessarily want to find out if that's what he is, because the cat tries to eat him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, don't eat a bee, don't eat a wasp, you know?
Yeah. Well, we don't have a lot of bees out here.
Yeah,
because we have flowers in the yard. All right, so in put a box.
The province I live in, there's like 114 different species of bees, apparently.
Oh, that's a lot of bees.
Yeah, a lot of different bees. fun bee facts.
Yeah. It's one of the many things you learn hanging out here. but yeah, I think having unpredictable elements, because otherwise you're back at the same thing at like two-fisting the game. Like, if you played any war game where you just set up the two armies, you build the armies yourself, you set them up, and you fight and just play both sides, there's unexpected elements in that, like, oh, these guys missed all their attacks, or this guy broke, or whatever. But that's not really the same, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think story, there's, like, story that always happens. This guy, like, never misses a shot, or this guy won two close combats in a row when he shouldn't. And then there's, like, story as in, like, this is the story of my crew of characters, and they have a history, and they are on a quest. And, like, I think that's a different, you know, mm-hmm. like, there's a different level of story. And I don't think all games generate that or necessarily care to.
Yeah, so yeah.
a lot of games are happy just being. It's the same, you know, if you've ever like played Spearhead in your case or Mordheim, and like there's just a cool moment and you like joke about what happened, or you talk about like, oh, that, you know, somebody like gets up and like waves their arms around to reenact it, you know, like that's story, but it's like lower S story as opposed to capital S story where it's like, you know, you start writing out like a big narrative.
Yeah, I feel like Mordheim has always been really good at creating that story because it does have unexpected things that will happen, not just in the gameplay, but also in the post-game.
I think the post-game is like where it starts, because in Mordheim you could like, it's been a while since I played, but you could like send your dudes out and they would like find some random thing in the city, right?
You could, you roll at the end to see what kind of exploration dice you get, you know.
Yeah.
Your hero fell in battle, then you roll on the chart to see what happened to them, and sometimes you get sent off to the slave pits to fight, and then maybe they win or maybe they don't. And if they do win, then they come back with all this cool stuff. And you're like, wow, that's neat.
Yeah, Necromunda had that too, where like you could get one of your dudes captured, and now you had to like play a mission to go like get them back, or you could have like, you know, your dudes could go to like collect money from like the bar that your gang owns, but they might drink it all up or whatever.
Mm-hmm. I've got two games of Spearhead under my belt now, and I'd say that nothing interesting ever really happens. I definitely went out there and I definitely fought, and I won once and I lost once, and they both kind of felt the same.
So you have had 100% of the Spearhead experiences, though.
Yeah, I think
so. Oh, wait, you haven't had a tie. I don't know if you could, like, draw.
I think you could, yeah. Yeah, I think you could.
I mean, you could come out even on points, I suppose.
Yeah, well, if I tie and I win and I lose, then I've balanced. I've gained everything I needed from Spearhead, and I can retire.
Now, after 2 Hour War Games kind of came and it didn't go away, I think he's still around, but he's definitely like scaled down a little bit. I think the guy's like looking to retire out of it. That's when like a bunch of stuff started popping out. Like COVID was kind of where a lot of it exploded, but some things were kind of around before. And I know you have a game on the list that is kind of in that.
Right before COVID.
Yeah, I was going to say it's before COVID, but it was like right around that time, and it definitely got a boost from...
It was 100% at the right time.
Yes.
Because, my first game is Rangers of Shadowdeep. And it was coming off of the question of, can we have Frostgrave that's solo?
Mm-hmm.
And so Rangers of Shadowdeep, I feel the main strengths for it as a solo or cooperative game is that it does tell a story. In this case, Joseph McCulloch has already written the story.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like all the groundwork is laid out. But as you play along, certain events are random and certain events will happen or not happen based on your actions.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a little bit of choose your own adventure, but mostly you are still following a set path.
Mm-hmm.
But as your characters are moving through it, they are gaining their own personalities. You know, you have failure, you have loss, you have death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people get a fatal injury. So it builds up some of the story, both in the miniatures as well as a well-crafted atmosphere through the written story.
Yeah, it's really like, it's almost like people always try to like cross like RPG ideas into war games and the other way around. And it's very much like, it's like an RPG campaign, right? But you're just battling through a miniature. You know, you have like scenarios where you encounter something specific happens and you fight certain creatures and stuff. The mission's all like very bespoke. Like they don't really feel the same. They're not randomly generated. They're, you know, specific encounters that you have. It has that feeling of like McCullough is like game mastering for you.
Yeah, exactly. You're railroaded, but it's not a bad thing.
Yeah. I mean, in the end, like, the guy planned that you're going to have to fight 7 spiders. So you got to go somewhere where there is 7 spiders. You know.
That's right.
There's the old, in RPG talk, there's a term called quantum ogres, which is that, or sometimes quantum bears. It's like you are in the forest, you see 3 paths, but no matter which path you take, you encounter the same 2 ogres.
Oh, yes.
So the ogres quantum exist.
Ogres.
Yep. So it's kind of the same sort of thing. But it's like the opposite of the 2 Hour War Games approach, right? Because in 2 Hour War Games, there's no set scenarios. You are always up against like randomly generated enemies based on like who you're fighting or what war it is or whatever. So it's like the exact opposite. Instead of everything being random, everything is like set. Or not everything, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. It's pretty well set. It could be a different playthrough experience every time. But the story will continue to be the same unless you die. You know, if you go from start to eventually when it's finished, because it's an ongoing story, not too much variation will happen.
It's like a very specific kind of experience, but it's the same as like buying like a D&D module and playing through that.
Yeah. And does add some expected, unexpected events. So you have to investigate clues and then roll on charts afterwards. And depending on the clue results you find will influence what you find as your results, which will give you different clues to build up a different story. So you don't always get the same kind of clues or the same kind of outcome that way.
Yeah.
And they also have battle events that happen after every round. So you draw a card and the card will tell you what event is going to happen. And so those will always be randomized as well. So, you know, some variation, but mostly it's a set path.
Yeah.
And so when I look at these kinds of games, like 2-Hour War Games or Rangers of Shadowdeep, I think, can you apply these to any game? So if you want to make any game a solo game, like how much work would it take? 2-Hour War Games, I think you assign rep, but otherwise you use the same stats?
You kind of, it's one of those things where like all of the games are kind of the same game, just with small differences. So like if you know how to play like the sci-fi game, it's almost the exact same rules for like playing with mechs or playing with spaceships or playing like World War II with nuts or whatever. So yeah, like it's very easy, and people have done that, but they've adapted to all kinds of stuff, and he's adapted to all kinds of stuff. There's like a colonial version, and it's like, I think there's even like a rank flank game. They all kind of use the same mechanics, so it's very easily adaptable in that sense. But because it is so abstract, it can also feel a little like things don't feel all that specific. Like there's a like space soldier with a laser rifle doesn't feel real different from like a World War II soldier with a bolt action, you know, because it is so heavy on the abstraction, which is one of those win some, lose some things. The more easy it is to adapt, sometimes the more like generic I think it'll feel.
And while Rangers of Shadowdeep is very specific, so certain things you could adapt, the way the AI is written is fairly adaptable to just about any miniature game, because
it's mostly
you have a shooter or you have a fighter, you know, basically is what it comes down to.
Yeah.
In a sci-fi game, you're gonna have lots of shooters, probably less fighters, but
And it's like a flowcharty. If then do X.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Which is, you know, the easy way to do it, which is nice. Mm-hmm. It's
So that's the other part, which, because in 2-Hour War Games, you roll for the reaction. I forget if it's like by squad or character or whatever. But the basic idea is that it's random. There's just like three possible outcomes they can have. And they're very kind of conditional. It's like one result would be like, if outnumbering the enemy, then advance. If not, stay in cover. You know, like that's kind of... But it is random and unpredictable. So you can have situations where like an enemy has... Like they have you outnumbered, but they decide to like hang back for a while. Which is realistic, like those things can happen. And even a human player might do that because they, in their head, they might not think it's as good a situation as you think it is.
Yeah, yeah.
But it can also lead to like weird situations, you know, like maybe they just never advance on the objective. Like,
we're not ready.
Yeah. They're just not feeling it, which is maybe fine. Like you run into a whole tank platoon and they don't attack you. That would be memorable. Whereas with the sort of flowchart approach, like you always know they're going to do something. You know, and it's predictable, which means you can kind of anticipate it, but also, you know, it moves quickly because you don't have to roll and check for each thing. You just kind of like, if you memorize how the like fighter AI works, you can go through that like real fast. You know what you're doing.
Yeah. Typically it'll make sense in the situation of why you're there, what's happening, what they're
doing. It also helps that those scenarios are like not that sprawling. Like they're each about like a specific situation and thing. So you don't have to have, like, he doesn't have to have rules for, like, a special flow chart for, like, if the spider is riding a horse cart. The spiders don't have horse carts in those scenarios, you know? So you can avoid some of the, like, trouble and complexity by narrowing down, like, the range of options.
I'd say the biggest challenge for adapting, like, a Rangers of Shadowdeep system to another system is mostly just that it is such a bespoke story. So yeah, you have to kind of... write your own story or chat GPT it or whatever you're going to do.
Yeah, you basically, and then that runs into the problem that if you're writing the story, you probably don't want to play that story.
Yeah, exactly. Already...
I mean, I guess you could like tell your own story like one step at a time. So you like come up with a story and then you go fight like the next villains. and it could work that way, but it's really more a thing where like you create the story and then I sit down and play that story. So it's better. I think it's more easily adapted if you are creating a game or a scenario or a story. Like there's nothing, I don't think there's a license for it, but in theory, there's nothing that says you couldn't create your own Rangers of Shadowdeep story that takes place like in a different location or after or before the events of McCullough's story.
You once ruled the realms with dice and a sword, painted goblins till tea, then your minis were stored. You grew up, got a job, bought a flat, wore a tie, swapped dragons for deadlines, your brushes went dry. Now the dishes are done and the kids are in bed. You climb to the attic to raise the undead. Crack open the paints that you swore you'd outgrown. The smell of acrylic, it feels like your home. There's grey in your beard, even more on your head, but you're splashing some colour on plastic and lead. So welcome back, General. What took you so long? Your hobby's still here. It's the place you belong. The Bedroom Battlefields Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Find it at bedroombattlefields.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, I think he has a license for that.
Oh, okay. So that might even be like stuff out there. But I know I've seen people who have kind of like, because people, you know, always create stuff.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
But creating a completely different thing, again, yeah, you have to like create your own, you know, it's very like bespoke experience.
Mm-hmm. The next game I want to talk about was BattleTech Aces.
Mm,
now, BattleTech Aces.
Neither played nor read. I've just seen like posts about it.
Yeah. Oddly enough, BattleTech Aces is Alpha Strike. It's not BattleTech.
Hey.
I mean, Alpha Strike is BattleTech, but it's not. BattleTech Aces is kind of a weird name. I don't know why they didn't say it's Alpha Strike Aces.
Mm-hmm. Probably just marketing.
Yeah, kind of a strange name, but it follows the regular movement phase of, or the gameplay phase of Alpha Strike, where you roll off to see who is, you know, has initiative, basically. I can't remember what they use as the term, but if you win, you could choose to have them move first, then you move, then you get to shoot, and then they shoot. So I think that in itself kind of lends to a nice solo experience, because you like one person has a clear advantage, one person has a clear disadvantage.
Right, right.
And their decision tree is very interesting. They use cards.
Mm-hmm.
So each mech is assigned a role on the master unit list. So if it's a striker, then it draws from the striker deck.
Mm-hmm.
And so you assign the cards off the top of the pile to each of the mechs that you have. This one's a brawler. And then they have a number on them. And the numbers will say who's going to go first and second. So this one's 781, they're going second. 195 is going first. And then they go into like a complex movement tree. I don't know if you can read that. It's like in a shiny sleeve.
Yeah, yeah. People who are not watching on their phone can probably read it just fine.
Yeah. So it's going to give you the move phase first and then the combat phase. And typically they have four or five options mm-hmm. of what kind of movement they're going to do based on which one makes sense. So if they're going first, say this brawler is going to jump 16 inches to the nearest enemy and no enemies in line of sight or wood slash cover from most enemies. So it gives them, that's what this unit wants to do. It wants to jump towards the nearest enemy as long as there's no enemies in line of sight. Mm-hmm. And it wants to get into woods or cover from the most enemies.
Right, right, right.
And then in combat phase, it'll say, you know, what its priority target is.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll say the closest range, can destroy, no cover, target modifier number, and then nearest. So it'll go through like each one. Which one is the best for that target? So it takes away a lot of the decision making you have to do on the decision.
Yeah, yeah.
So in like a decision tree AI, where it tells you, you know, the brawler wants to go move towards either the closest enemy and fight them, or they want to go to the objective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, usually like that's the standard AI. Instead, this one will assign different AIs to each unit, but it's all in the back of the card, so you can just read it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it kind of gives you the like illusion that they have like different pilots who might approach things in a different way or might have a different approach to things. Or...
Yeah, and they're not necessarily making the same decisions all the time, so it can add kind of unexpected elements. When we were playing against some battle pods, we're playing some mechs against battle pods, and the battle pods had a very long jump, so when the cards told them to jump, they could jump just about anywhere.
Mm.
And sometimes they would jump like behind us and then start shooting. So it was like an unexpected thing. You wouldn't have expected them just to go behind
like
you.
It's like the route authentic Macross experience, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So in that aspect, I think it made a really cool kind of unpredictable enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And that one also would be, I think, a nightmare to set up on your own.
Yeah, you kind of have to, because the cards are like very specific. It sounds like two Battletech. If you don't have units that move and operate and fight like Battletech units, you're going to run it. And creating like an entire card deck is a lot of work. But the cool thing would be that if you did something like that, even if you make them simpler, you say this, maybe only like three options because you're just doing like fantasy guys.
Okay.
Yeah. But you could then add new cards in whenever you want. Like if you come up with a new card, or you could add cards for specific. So maybe you have like, instead of being mech types, maybe they're like orc cards. So the orcs are more likely to like come at you, whereas the elves are more likely to like sneak around. Maybe the goblins have options where they try to like summon more goblins or something. So you could, but it would be like a bunch of work. I guess you could just get like index cards and put them in like, cut them and put them in sleeves or something.
Yeah, you could do
that. You know, depending how, I mean, a lot of these things can also be like slimmed down and made simpler, you know? Or you could even have like, this is probably too much work, but you could have like a random roll. So you have like a 1d6 roll on the card. So on this particular type of enemy, he will now like be really aggressive on like a roll of 1 or 2, and he'll be like moderately aggressive on a 4 or 5, and on 6 he will try to like do something different.
Yeah.
You know, go to college and get a job.
Write his mom.
Yeah, you know. It was even orcs have mothers, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, so that's like a whole different approach. And I assume this is all like, you're still playing like Battletech style, where you're kind of like just setting up a battle with some units and fighting it out.
Yeah, exactly. And you could tie it into a campaign. Alpha Strike doesn't necessarily have to have a campaign.
Yeah.
I'm actually kind of confused as to where exactly to find the campaigns usually, but I think the Hinterlands is the new one that's come out.
Oh, okay. I know Battletech has like a huge
Battletech's campaign still thing. Covered. Yeah. They got lots.
So
for me, that one added a lot of unpredictability, which created some story, but didn't have like a high amount of story. You know, there wasn't necessarily a lot of motivation, I feel, between either units, except for that they had to go out there and scrap it out. And some of them did strange things. That was cool.
I think that's always been an element, especially with Battletech, that like you're supposed to kind of like know all the like units and stuff and what armies they're from and what worlds they're from. And then you create pilots and you like, you're supposed to kind of have all of that so you can like build part of the story that way. Because I have a friend who's like really into Battletech, and they know like all of the different like planets and armies and mercenary units and which specific mechs they use at which time and why they don't use the other mechs anymore because something happened. And if you have all of that information, then, you know, I think some of that becomes like obvious, like, oh, I want to use these guys. That means they must be from whatever, Jensen's Marauders or something. And therefore, it should be a mission because they only do like commando raids. So you kind of get like that whole chain going.
Yeah. Bringing in the lore often will help in these circumstances. Yeah.
If you imagine like this big blank piece of paper, and if you don't know anything, that like the whole piece of paper is blank. But if you know like all the lore to Battletech, then like half of it is already filled in and you only have to worry about the other half. You know, so it's like, or if you have like the cards, they take a bunch of the decision making. They don't remove all of it, it sounds like, but like most of the decision making. It's not like a different piece of that paper is like filled in. It's not like that. But the part that sounds like it probably isn't is like who you're actually fighting, right?
Yeah.
You still have to like pick out, you know, based on the models you have or whatever you got going. And Catalyst wants you to buy more mechs.
Yeah. So they don't have a consolidated solo system at the moment, at least. Because this was just the beta that they produced with the previous Kickstarter. I know they have a new box coming out, Scouring Sands. It's going to be Jade Falcon focused. So I assume it's going to have the campaign baked in and more storytelling as you go along, which is pretty exciting. Because lore on Battletech, I think, is pretty sweet. Most of my collecting Battletech just involves buying the mech packs. Then I go on to Sarna.net and I read where this mech could possibly go into. And I'll get a little list. I'm like, okay, I'll come back to you, mechs. You're going in the pile. And eventually I'll build one of these forces and I'll look through and I'll be like, okay, we'll take this one, and this one. Throw it in there.
And make sure you have the exact variant, because if the head-mounted laser is pointing to the other side, then it's actually a completely different machine.
That's right.
So,
all right. Yeah, so that's Battletech Aces for Alpha Strike. It's really the lack of consequences at the end, I think, that bring it down as a solo experience. Yeah. Because, but, you know, I don't care if these guys live or die, I guess, in the end, because it doesn't matter. You just clean it up to people afterwards.
So, but maybe that comes someday. And certainly, if you were somehow hacking this to work with, like, full Battletech, there's, like,
entirely too much of that stuff.
Oh yes,
you,
yes.
You can figure out like the salvage value of like the broken up arms and all that stuff.
I'm going to pull up my notes because the third game I want to talk about is the new hotness, Guards of Traitor's Toll.
Yeah, it's been all over the interwebs. And it looks like a really interesting idea. It's also just a fun idea because you're basically playing like the city guard, which is like, you know, in any game where there's city guards, you always like beat up on them, or yeah. they're there to like beat up on you as the adventurer if you yeah. do some crime. So it's like turning it upside down and saying, okay, like you get to play as these like poor assholes who have to keep everyone in line, like a belligerent fantasy city.
But I think it's even better than that because it gives you a reason to have civilians.
Mm-hmm.
There's almost never a reason to have civilians in a game. They could be an objective, you know, or they could be the things you have to save or murder, I guess, if you're playing that kind of game.
Yeah. Or they just like get in the way.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But these are an integral part of the game. If you don't have these civilians, then there's no point to even playing the game. Mm-hmm. So I think that's pretty phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
I've never played it. I've just been listening to people playing it. And the things that interested me most were kind of the activation system, I think, is what really gets my brain juices going when I'm driving to work, listening to the podcast. It's you have a big bucket of tokens. And in that bucket, there's going to be guard actions, suspect actions, plot, and time. So when you draw the guard actions, that's when you're allowed to start trying to get your guards to do what they need to do. When you get the suspect actions, I think it sounds like you have to like roll on a chart, or maybe there's a card that you draw. And it's going to give you a description. And it sounds like, okay, you need someone who has something to do with food.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a suspect for this reason. So then you look at all the civilians and you see like a lady who's holding a fish. Like, okay, she's the suspect. We think that she is doing this thing.
Yeah.
So you have to go over there and do some guard actions against her.
Right, right.
Yeah. Then the plot tokens will add a random battle event, basically, in most war games. In this case, it's mostly civilians getting all uppity on something, or maybe a fire breaks out, you know, some sort of like kind of city related events is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then your time tokens, you have three. And when you pull the third time token, it's over. So that's your turn.
Ooh.
So you never know. Yeah. How much time you have to all these, you know, to work through all these actions. And you're battling against not just time, but dissent.
Mm-hmm.
Dissidents. Yeah. Dissidents. And the higher the dissonance goes, the closer you are to failing the mission. You can balance it out by getting coins. So, you know, being rewarded or rolling certain dice can give you coins to help you balance out against that dissonance. So it adds like a lot of moving parts all at once. Yeah. And when I first read it, I thought it sounded way too complicated. I'm like, I don't think this would be a particularly great game. There's like way too much going on. But as I listen to people playing it, like the hobby homies, everything just kind of clicks into place. And yeah, I think this would be a very easy system to implement into a lot of games because it's a very simple concept overall. You're just drawing chits to see what happens.
Yeah, and you can miss with... That's one of the things... I usually call that a lever in the when you're designing things. Anything you can like then assign things to. Because if you have time tokens in your bag, now you can modify like how many of them are in the bag. You can modify if any of them gets added or removed, or if things happen on a certain number of tokens, time tokens, or like you just have like so many things you can like glue on to that when you're making a scenario.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the it feels like a board game. Oh no, sorry, it doesn't feel. It sounds like a board game when I listen to it, but an interesting board game because you have lots of terrain and miniatures.
Unlike regular board games, who are boring and lame.
Yeah, you just sit around a table and do whatever.
Yeah. Nobody at best time.
I'll just say hi to Mini Warmut.
Hey.
No problems being late.
Yeah.
Lon
Jenny. Everyone is late for something.
Yeah, they're going to make one, which I think is a chit-based system.
Oh.
Maybe not. Maybe they're going to make a civilian. Maybe they're going to make a pie. I don't know.
Maybe they're going to make a game where you play as the food that the old lady was carrying around.
That's right.
So, very small decision space, but interesting nonetheless.
And the starter box is a phenomenal value.
Yeah, I was seeing, at first I got, because you always see when there's like a game that comes out with a bunch of miniatures, you get the assumption, or you wonder how many people are kickstarting just to get the miniatures. Yeah. And I thought it was like that at first, but then I started hearing a little bit more about it. And like, oh, okay, this is actually like both really creative and like fun, but also you know, like an actual interesting game there.
So. The only thing I would say doesn't really tickle my fancy as much is the bespoke dice. Because, I mean, I understand it's an integral part of the system. You can't just make your guards do things. You have to roll the dice, and based on what the dice say is what you're allowed to do with those guards. And maybe they're not even going to do the right thing.
Yeah. So you're kind of managing, like, a squad of idiots.
Yeah, exactly. Grimdark is the pie. Yeah, perfect. Grimdark pie sounds not so tasty.
Yeah, that might be full of, like, goblin bits or something.
It's the Brussels sprout pie of Grimdark.
The other green meat.
All right. Well, that, I think, wraps up what I had to say about
Well, that's kind of cool. Yeah, this isn't really intended as, like, a comprehensive, you know, we'll be here fucking all night. More just, like, a slice of, like, different ways people have kind of done this and, like, done it over time and different approaches to things. But it's kind of interesting because one of the things I'd written down on my little snippet here to talk about solo design is the approach of the AI. It's, like, one of the first things you kind of have to figure out. Like, how does the enemy decide what to do? And I always kind of suspect that, like, probably a third of the players just ignore that anyway, and they just, like, do whatever. They basically two-fist it and do whatever. Like, when I did, like, Parsecs and Leaks, it's kind of a flowchart, I guess, where it's more like, okay, if an enemy is like this, then in certain situations they should do something like this. So, like, if they are aggressive, they will advance on you and try to stick to cover. And there's kind of, like, it's like a sliding scale when you do that of, like, on one end, you can be very, like, if they are within 12 inches and line of sight of enemies, but more than 6 inches from cover, unless facing enemies with laser, you know. Like, you can put as many conditions on as you want. And on the other end, it's, like, very simple, you know. Like, they will advance in cover and try to get a good shot. And then the player is kind of left to, like, interpret what that means for the specific situation. Which is funny, because that's the thing that people, like, sometimes feel like very strongly about. Like, some people very much want the game to, like, make all the decisions, and some people are fine, like, interjecting, like, their own interpretation or their own, like, what does that mean in the given situation. Like, you'll sometimes see posts from people who, like, are very proud of the fact that they don't let the take stupid moves for the AI or something, and some people prefer, like, being able to outwit the system, like it's a computer game or something. So it's not really like a right or wrong answer. You can do, like, the tutorial war game solution with having, like, some games will have, like, just a table you roll. Some will have cards. I think the Skyrim one, Call to Arms or something, that has, like, a flowchart system. Actually, it feels a lot. In conception, it's very similar to the Rangers system.
Oh, okay.
Where it's like, if X, then do Y. Then you kind of move down. That's like three or four, like, steps or something. If you want to pop up Jennings' comment, because it's kind of apropos of what's going on. For a guideline rather than a flowchart, I myself said to do what makes most sense. I'll be doing a more enemy personality description to guide the AI. I think that works really well. Because I think it also allows players to, like, inject a little bit of interpretation in it. Like, if they are playing, and they will have an idea of what it means for an enemy to be aggressive in, like, a specific situation, or playing tactically or defensively or something. There's also, of course, there's, like, a complexity to it, because you could have a game where, like, every single, if it's a World War II game, then all the dudes with the rifles have a different AI, and the guy with the submachine gun, and the guy with the pistol. You can, like, make that as complicated as you want, but I think for a lot of people, if there's more than just, like, one sheet of paper or, like, a couple of cards, it starts getting, like, out of hand. Trying to handle all of that stuff. It's also, you start kind of realizing there's, like, a limit to how many things you can account for. Because, like, let's say, like, you have your flowchart and your infantry is supposed to advance towards the next position and cover towards the objective. But if there is a huge space tank, like, watching them, maybe they should be responding differently, but, like, you can go mad trying to account for, like, every possible, you know. One thing I did in a couple of older games was put in, basically, you sort of, whenever you're making a risky move, you can sort of assign, like, a, like, how willing is the enemy to take risks, and you just roll a d6. So if they're, like, really, if they're, like, orcs or something, maybe it's a 5, and any roll of 1 to 5, they will take the risky option. But on a 6, they will actually, like, to the cautious one. Then maybe elves, it's a two, so they're more likely to pick a cautious option. Like, you can have a couple of like sort of simple mechanics like that to like let the player decide. And in the end, you could probably just like roll like odds and evens, you know. But there's also like all, you know, because when you move, like if you take like one squad of dudes, you're moving them, you're going to be making like 1,000 little decisions. Like, do I put this guy like on this side of the rock or on the other side of the rock? And then do I put the next guy like real close to him or a little further away? Do I, you know, so at some point, like as a player, you're going to have to make those decisions anyway. You know, we can't do a flow chart for like how to position each of like 40 orcs in your army.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, it'll just get mad. Like, you will fall asleep reading the flowchart. You won't even get to fall asleep reading the rules.
Half a game.
Which kind of leads into, this is a mantra that I have repeated often and some people don't really like, but it is that a solo game, in my humble opinion, should be like 10% simpler than if you were writing it to be played with somebody. Because if you're playing it solo, you are going to have to manage all of it on your own. So if like there's 7 steps to close combat and it's easy to miss one of them, guess what? Your player will probably miss one of them. If there's a bunch of different actions to take, again, not only do you have to figure out how the AI handles those actions, but you also have to, as a player, just remember they exist at all. So in general, and I think I've said it before, but like I get really discouraged if I am playing a game solo and I realize like I screwed up the rules. That really, really bugs me. So if you can look at like the level of complexity you would design a game for if you're designing it to be played with two people, because even if both people don't know the rules that way, you're still going to be like reminding each other of like, because you're going to remember like different things. Or if you forget to like take a morale check, your opponent will remind you. So take like that level and then ratchet down by like 10% or so. And that is usually, in my experience, the better level to be at for a solo game. Because again, you're just going to have one person. And especially if it's a game where there's a lot of setup. Like people sometimes comment if you're playing like Parsecs, you spend like as much time like setting up and resolving afterwards that you ever do like moving dudes around.
Yep.
So, which is intentional. But if that's the case, again, like the rules have to be kind of on the simpler side because you're going to be spending a lot of time doing other stuff as well, pawing through the book and stuff. So keep it kind of simple. The third point is kind of back to what you're saying about story. And I found like the simplest trick. I think I've mentioned it before when we've talked, but it's hooks. So a hook is anything that you can, that tie one part of the game into a different part of the game. So the classic example is in Five Leagues that when you win a battle, you go to a table that where you roll to see if you find something like the enemy camp. And one of the things you might find is some prisoners. And then there's a little subtable and those prisoners might give you some information. And that information might send you back to a city to take on a contract. And that contract, when you go to do that, you have to travel to a location, and that location can spawn like a new quest. So different elements of the game will connect back into a different part of the rules. It might be something as simple as like you find something and you now have to go to a different location if you have a map. And when you get there, you can try to play a special mission, or it can be as involved as you want, but anything that hooks back into itself, or like, one of the simpler is like if you meet a NPC and there's a chance that NPC will cause like the next battle to be more difficult because they betrayed you. Like stuff like that is really simple and it automatically gets the player going and trying to like piece together like the logic of this. And from there, like you could just cheat and let their imagination, because they'll come up with an idea. Because maybe they decided that like the mission they were originally on was actually by like, you know, like the orc mafia or something in the city. And then it makes perfect sense that, oh, of course the mafia would have, like, they would want you to go out and get one of their dudes back because he has some secret information. So actually, the mission we got is us following up on that information and, like, trying to heist the mafia's loot or something. Like, it could be anything. You don't have to do any of that. You just have to, like, tie the threads together to, like, make stuff happen.
Yeah, a lot of people's imaginations will just start pulling pieces together.
Yeah. And whatever they come up with will be way cooler than what you would have come up with anyway, because they came up with it custom fitted to their game. So it's kind of cheating. Like the simplest version of this is from Necromunda. Like I said before, one of the injury results, if a guy gets shot, is that he's captured, and you then have to play a separate mission to go rescue him. Mm-hmm. Like, that's as simple as it gets, but it's an event in one game that directly calls you to do something different, you know? So, yeah, it's really effective, and it's, like, such a cheap... Now, there is a downside to it, which is that everything is now super integrated. So if you decide to, like, change one of the tables, you might now... or change how something works. Now everything is, like, glued together, and it becomes very difficult to, like, make adjustments to things, like, out of. There is an advantage to games that are blocks that can be swapped in and out. Like, so making hooks is not free, but it's just a really effective way of doing, like, a game that is intended to have story. If you're not intending to have capital S story, you just want the lower S, like, procedural experience where unexpected things happen, you don't have to do that, and you might want to not do it very, and then spend all your effort on, like, something else.
And of course, there's people like me who are very big fans of the social system and Weasel Tech.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think people, until they actually play it, will realize how much that really adds to a game.
Yeah. it's also a thing where you have to, like, I think it helps if you, like, understand what the source material is trying to do, because otherwise, yeah. I think it feels kind of weird. But that's another element, too, where, like, you can have mechanics that, like, push you to, like, engage with the game in a very specific way.
Mm-hmm.
Like the random thing you find in Mortheim is, like, because it gives you, like, a snapshot of, like, what the city is like, or the ruins of the city. So it, like, pulls you into the world a little. Or the fact in, like, Necromunda that a lot of the, when you send your gang dudes out to, like, collect money, like, a lot of the chances are, like, they have a chance of, like, being injured or drunk or gambling away your money or something. Mm-hmm. So it kind of gives this idea they're all, like, idiot lowlives.
Yeah.
You know. Like, we've all gone to school with some of those dudes.
Maybe every day.
Yeah. Maybe we
maybe
were.
It was you.
Yes. If you didn't know an idiot lowlife, then your teacher was disappointed in you. If you wrote AC/DC logos on your binder.
That's right.
Didn't amount to anything, but probably had a good time. But yeah, that was kind of the, I guess, the three sort of, you know, think about how you build the AI system and kind of what you want out of it, how much time you want the player to spend engaging with it. Try to keep things a little simpler. And now you don't, the simplicity thing, there is a market for people who like a really crunchy, heavy game to mess with. But that audience is very specific, and it's not very big.
And they probably play role-playing games.
Yes. Or they're, I mean, there was a solo system for Advanced Squad Leader. The book is, like, as big as the actual rule book, so.
Dang.
Yeah. I solo ASL, and I just two-fist that, because that is about the level I can handle. I can't handle, like, another game on top of it teaching how to play it. But yeah, so consider simplifying a little bit. And if you want a story to be generated by the game as opposed to just vibes, then consider hooking mechanics back into each other. If you prefer just having vibes, or maybe it's just more focused on the, like, individual battles, then probably don't do that and just kind of focus on having maybe more unpredictable things in the mission. You can find, you know, as your squad is going through Vietnam, they find like a... you know, the corpse of an officer with, like, an important map or something. Like, you can still have interesting, cool things happen. But then you probably want to have that happen, like, during the mission instead.
Mm-hmm. And have a lot of things going on that can make them not happen, such as, like, that chit system of guards trade a toll or battle events in general.
Yeah, anything. Unpredictability is, like, a really big thing for solo gaming. And I think you have to be careful because there is an element to, like, having too many random things where it feels like you don't get to play. But in general, I think most solo gamers enjoy having, like, random events. That's, like, you almost always will benefit from throwing in an extra event table somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you can, like, because you can parcel out a little bit. So you might have, like, one during battles and you have one table before and one after or something like that. And you can have, like, it's okay in a solo game. Minimud is mentioning, like, the dice were mean to him. And sometimes, like, in a solo game, it can be totally okay to lose and get your ass kicked because something unexpected happens. Like, you don't necessarily want to have all the time, but sometimes it's fun because it I think everyone has had that experience when you're playing a role-playing game and you realize that the GM kind of just wants you to win because they just want these characters to go on and tell mm-hmm. their story. And there's a different feeling to like a story that you truly don't know how it's going to end because 200 gene stealers might show up and eat everybody, you know? So there's definitely like a value to that. Again, it depends on like what you're trying to. Some solo games are very much about trying to win, and some solo games are more like they just assume you'll keep playing. Like Parsecs, it's pretty hard to like bomb out so badly that your campaign is dead. You're just kind of meant to keep going.
Yeah, I don't think I've actually heard of anyone happening that happened.
No, before. I've seen people like
story points help.
Yeah. Like sometimes people will get their ass kicked and they'll just decide like, oh, okay, that must have meant they all got like eaten by bugs or something. But
yeah,
by the rules, it's pretty hard to make it happen. I've heard a lot more people getting mangled trying to get started in five leagues because they hit to the nearest dungeon and find like 200 skeletons.
Yeah.
We had
the hardest game Ash ever played.
Yeah, that was like an evolution of like from start to finish. So he's kind of like came to terms with it and started realizing. But that's also one of those things where it's like, how much do you tell people like how to play the game, or do you just let them figure it out?
Yeah,
you know. So there's a value to both. But that's kind of like the extent I have. I feel like this is a topic we can probably go like into super detail with. But that's probably also like for a second episode down the road because we're burning up to an hour or so.
Yeah. I do have one last question though before we head off. Let's touch base. So yeah, many more of what I was just talking about is OPR Star Quest.
Mm-hmm.
That game, solo or cooperative.
Mm-hmm.
And it's cool in the fact that the app will generate what enemies you're going to face.
Mm-hmm.
But you build an army list of those enemies first. So you're only playing against miniatures you have.
Yeah, and you almost have to in a case like that.
Yeah. So you never know what you're going to face, but you always know what you're going to face.
Yeah, it's from your gaming shelf.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's cool. A pretty cool system. Yeah, that was some game. I've ripped this idea up a few times, but there is some game I had seen. There's a little RPG, and it was the idea was you put like six monsters on a list, and you when the players like go into the next dungeon, you roll it. A d6, and you just count from the top. Then you strike that monster out and add a new monster at the bottom.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then you just keep going. So each time you roll a d6, and it was the same, like, if you write, like, six people you can meet while traveling, and then when they meet one of them, you strike him out, and then you put a new guy. So it just keeps going.
Nice.
So, yeah, it was a really cool idea, and it's very simple to do. You can do that on your own. You know, you can adapt it to anything you want. You could even have them, like, you know, if you had like a campaign where you travel around a map, you could have like little index cards for like each spot on the map, and they all have their own little tables. You just keep
nice.
So yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So my question though, before we wrapped it, was Elf Knight Pike Sword.
Yeah.
You have considered solo.
I have. It was actually a promise, and then I realized that I was going to have to tackle that.
Like, have you decided like any systems so far that seem like good contenders? You know, nothing set in stone.
Yeah, what I'm leaning towards is that it will be mostly a flowcharty thing, but you will make a couple of rolls to determine. What I would like to do is something where the roll for like the enemy's plan also affects like how they do it. So like there is a possibility that this is again like ideally like, but it would be cool if they're gonna try to like advance to hold the middle of the field. But then that means there's a chance now each turn, and it increases that there will be more troops arriving on the flanks. So that's the point of them doing that. Or they will hang back and hold the line, and that means that their missile troops get more ammo, or something like that. So, like,
okay.
The way they approach the battle will also affect, like, how they do. But I need to... The problem is that it has to scale from, like, five guys to, like, however, 40. And not all having, like... You know, a dragon show as reinforcements is cooler if you have like a lot of troops to fight the dragon with.
Mm-hmm.
So it's possibly maybe a little simpler than that. We'll see. I also have some ideas for like game mastered mode that I'm really excited about, but
Ooh. But
that's the opposite of solo. Although it could be played with one player and a game master, or you could game master for yourself, I suppose. I used to do that when I was a kid. If my friends weren't home and I wanted to play RPGs, I would just like roll some characters and then I would like have them fight in a dungeon or something.
Nice.
So, yeah.
I remember I had a D&D book that had like a solo adventure built into it.
Yeah, that was
like you start off as a prisoner, then you had to go through like the hallways and you could meet people and they'd come with you.
It was kind of like that when I was a kid. Yeah. It was kind of like one of those like fighting fantasy.
Yeah. This one is actually had, I remember it had miniatures and it had like a little red booklets that you put stuff into. It was a long time ago and I had to hide it and I don't really remember what it was anymore.
It's a terrible fate.
Yeah.
Mini Warmouts asked, will this only be in PDF? I would like to get it done up to do print on demand. The problem is I want to make sure that there is not a pile of errors that are like lurking out there. Also, there are some questions right now about, because DriveThru have talked about like having to increase the prices for print on demand quite a bit because of paper prices. Right.
You want our paper, huh?
Yeah.
You're gonna pay.
We can have it print. I have some like old index cards. We can like send them and they can print the book in like pocket format. Yeah. This will be the recession size wargaming book. So it's a question of, because there's like the way it works with the print on demand is that you pay like per copy and it's a lot more than you would pay for like a real print because you're only printing them on demand instead of printing like 1,000. So the margin is like razor thin on that. So I need to find out if like, because I'd like to like at least like earn a dollar off it, you know. So I need to find out if it's actually like viable or not. And if we do a print on demand, then obviously there needs to be like a little more flair. It can still be pretty guerrilla because it's a war game, but you know, do need a couple of photographs or something.
Yeah, so, sexy it up a little. I mean, it does have elf on the name, so it has to be, you know.
Yeah, we have to have some big titty elves in there.
Yeah.
And yeah, you can get it printed yourself, or you can send it to, like, if you're stateside, you can send it to, I always use Print Me One. It's one of those websites. There's a couple of them, but you can upload it, and they'll just print it for you and mail it to you. They do, like, a nice spiral bound. I just want to make sure, first and foremost, that, like, all of the inevitable, like, bugs and errors are as many of them as possible as have been ironed out. And there were a couple, I know, like, I cut Lizard Men, because I was just trying to get the book done. There's, like, one or two more armies and some more spells that need doing. So, yeah, consideration. I will admit there's just a huge advantage to sticking with PDF and letting people do books prints themselves, just because I really want to be able to like update books and add to them. That's kind of like the new vibe. And that obviously runs into a problem that if you bought the print version, then you're stuck with like that version. So I don't know. Maybe that's not actually a concern, but that's the rationale. I hope that makes sense. Wormont.
They bought version 1 and we're all working on 1.5 now.
Yeah. That was old thinking. Point and laugh at that dude when he shows up.
Ledanto asks, is there cake left? Because he arrived late. And I think he knows that the cake is a lie, so we don't have to answer that question.
Yes. I guess any like final questions before I complain a little bit about Roguehammer?
You're going to complain about Roguehammer?
I'm mostly just going to bemoan my fate because I spent like 2 days doing literally nothing from I got out of bed until I got done. Just like pouring through old 40k army lists and books creating unit stats. And after a while, it just starts becoming, because there's so many like units that are like close combat dudes with pistols. So you have to like make sure that the stats are not exactly identical or create a new ability for some of them. And it gets a lot. And you have to. So I am going slightly mad doing it. The good news is that the amount of army stuff in there is going to be absolutely bananas, because it is going to try and capture. The goal was to capture every army list thing that was in either Rogue Trader, Second Edition, a couple of selected from Third Edition, plus a few things of my own, like the Hired Guns list and the Rebels and Dissidents list, including some things that like existed but like didn't ever go anywhere. So there'll be a separate like orc renegade list, freebooter list, so it'll be a lot. Plus there will be some expanded armies that will definitely not feature like popular sci-fi stuff, but I need to make sure that there's enough units to make something out of them, so I have some ideas. But it would be cool to have like I'm not saying that you could have like the Doctor and Darth Vader like fighting the Tyranids, but you know, if that was a thing, that would be kind of cool.
Could happen.
Yeah. Or
there was a question on the Hobby Homies Patreon. Mm-hmm. That was, what is your absolute most favorite faction, like ever?
Any game?
Any game ever.
Okay. I assume this means like a tabletop game then. Okay, I'm going to be really boring and say that it is, if it is a faction just in its like whole conception, it was, for anyone who's played Warzone or Mutant Chronicles, it was Bauhaus, which were like the Germans. Otherwise, it's just Imperial Guard in 40K. I always vote for the regular humans with the big artillery.
Okay. When you see the Imperial Guard in your head, are you seeing like any specific kinds, or is it just the Imperial Guard? Like the guys, they got hats on?
Nope. It is very specific. Okay. It is the original metal Cadian shock troops from second edition with the red helmet, or yeah, they had red helmets and like the red las guns. Okay. And like they had kind of like spotted camouflage. Those original metal models. That and the original metal Catachan before the really shitty plastics.
Oh, yes, yes.
Those two. Now, there's lots of other really great, like the Valhounds, the Steel Legions. There's been lots of great Imperial Guard minis. Like almost every Guard mini has been great. But like the platonic ideal of the Imperial Guard to me is that metal. And it is both because they were really good. Okay. But it is also because the first White Dwarf I ever read was 182 with. That box came out and had the rules for them, and I read it before knowing what Warhammer really was, and I was like, these guys must be the coolest dudes in the world. Nice. So yes, metal Cadian shock troops with the red helmets and red lasers, that is the shit. that is my voice. Beyond that, basically I always go for like the grunts, so anything that comes close to that. Ornless is a fantasy thing that if it's a role-playing game, I just play like the closest thing to a fighter with a sword and board.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That the game will let me, but no. For factions, it's the Imperial Guard.
Nice.
Warmut says, cool, you have Slammer available. Yes, I was really excited about that. We are working on some ideas to, like, probably touch up the original rules a little and then figure out what a true second edition might look like. But I was really excited about just, like, getting it back out there and making it available to people. The website had essentially, like, disintegrated into... It was one of those things where I think the service that it was originally hosted on had, like, technically stopped working, but the server was still running somewhere. And then one day it was just gone. So, yeah, we are talking about, like, tidying it up, slimming down, like, some of the modifiers and just making things a little more distinct and a little cooler. And then see what, like, a real second edition could look like.
Nice. So,
but, yeah, that's totally a thing. Yeah, that's about, like, all I got. I guess any final questions from the... the folks in the chat, all like five of you.
Yeah, takes about 7 seconds roughly to catch up.
Yeah. Oh, you're up to 670 subscribers. Look at you go.
Yeah, I've been spamming shorts because Restream will just automatically make shorts. I'm like, well, I'll just take advantage of that then.
Oh, okay, yeah, shorts. In that case.
And then I learned how to edit it so that you're not tiny Ivan. I can make you into regular size Ivan.
Yeah.
And then I switched it so that you're on top and I'm on bottom because my camera has me looking up a little bit and you're always looking down a little bit. So
ties together nicely. Yeah, now it looks like it's intentional. That's great.
Yeah. So slowly the shorts are getting better looking at least.
Yeah. I noticed that in the shorts, because it's cut down to only 10 seconds, I only say the word like 200 times. So that also feels better. I have never lived in California, but I think I was just like meant to be a California Valley girl.
That's,
just,
that's right.
We all have somebody inside like waiting to come out. And in my case, it's like a California high schooler.
I put Lord Krell on a tiny little square base.
Ooh.
Originally, he was on the tiny base like this.
Yeah.
And then I moved him to a 25 because I think the 25 looks better. But someone in our local gaming group offered to print me some of the movement trays that will adapt from 20 to 25.
Oh, okay.
Frontage, so that when I play rank and flank games with my old guys, they can look better, and but they'll have a nicer big frontage. That's so awesome. I'm super excited.
Get them, yeah, that's cool. You can still get some use out of them.
Yeah.
It's interesting how many rank and flank games have started like being very flexible with things like frontage and stuff.
Yeah. This one is, Age of Fantasy Regiments again, so.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm adopting the unit fillers. So I had some tombstones on hand.
Oh.
So I put them on square bases too. And so now I can bulk out my troops without having to buy really expensive old hammer minis.
Yeah, some of that stuff gets up there. Avoid anything that says on eBay that it's out of print or rare. That means they doubled the price tag.
Yeah, like this guy, he's got to be worth like $80 now or something.
Some of them are pretty spendy. Until you find like some dude selling like 200 of the same guy, and they're all like really crisp and have never been painted.
It's immaculate. It's so weird.
Yeah, those are definitely legit. When I was buying some second edition Space Marines, I'm pretty sure a couple of that I got. But it was funny because the photos were of like actual old minis, because they had that kind of like dull, grungy look to them. And then what I got in the mail were like that crisp, very silvery.
Slightly hard.
Yeah, it's like very hard and brittle.
It's like, this is a little more brittle than I was remembering.
Yeah, and for figures that I know was before white metal. So
yeah,
I was like, yeah, these were never cast in that. And even if they were, like the odds are pretty low. So yeah, they were. I mean, the figures were fine. They look great. They probably look sharper than if I got the actual mini.
Some of my guys are lead, and some of them are white metal, which is appropriate for depending on which era. But I forgot how much of a joy lead is just overall as a feeling.
Oh, yeah. Lead minis are just so much nicer. So much white metal sucks ass.
Yeah, it really does.
And on that note, bad is when they did that stupid like resin stuff. That was bad.
Fine cast, yeah.
Oh, my God, yeah. That was the worst. Nightmares.
Well, everyone's good. We're good. I think we're going to wrap it up here.
Yeah. I hope everyone had an excellent evening. I did not lose power despite a storm being on.
Hooray.
So, which means it'll just disappear immediately as soon as we log off.
That's right. Okay, you ready for a heart attack?
Yep.
And
heart explosion. Oh, no heart. We're heartless. It only works when it wants to. Oh, now it's popping up a thing about turning on reactions, so we can't do anything.
Oh, I see.
All right.
Well, maybe next time. All right. Peace, everyone. Bye.
Peace. Bye.
This episode of Bad Internet Friends was streamed live on YouTube and Twitch. There is a North American-friendly live stream every second Wednesday of the month, and a European-friendly live stream every fourth Monday of the month.